this sheet here, the top side. So on your way out, if you want to pick up the handout that she was going to give, make sure you do that. So it's available out there. And then the other announcement is that the Water Center Annual Review of Research is next Wednesday up in the hub from 8 to 5. And this program, Jill, I think there's some extra ones out there, but it's on the wall. But we need a couple more volunteers to help us with that, with it's a valve that you have to put in. But it's just helping out with it, and you actually get credit for missing one of the classes here. So if you missed a class or you anticipate missing a class, then see Debbie there or email us. How many hours is it? Is it 2 hours? It's 2 hours, right. And of course, I get to see the program. But that way, if you feel like you need to make it up in terms of missed class, then you can do it by helping us out with the annual review of the Water Center research. Okay. So see Debbie if you got any questions. All right, so today's speaker is Phil Vogt over here. He's a Washington State climatologist and is a national leader in analyzing the impact of climate change, including variations in Pacific Northwest and national snowpacks, sea levels, water resources, precipitation, and temperatures. He has a PhD in atmospheric sciences from the University of Washington and an undergraduate degree in physics from Harvard University. And he joined the UW in 1998 as a research scientist with the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmospheres and Oceans, Climate Impact Group. And then he got the title of Washington State Climatologist in 2003. So he's a key player in the regional research on climate change, and his work has received national and international recognition. And he shared the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 with other co-authors and researchers from the University of Washington around the world. So they work on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in 2008, he was named one of Seattle's most influential people and honored with the UW Distinguished Staff Award. But unfortunately, he's actually going to move to Corvallis, Oregon in the summer. In fact, he's been lured away, I guess. He's actually working there part-time starting in March. And he's going to become the director of the New Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University, and will be a professor in the College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. So today, he's going to tell us about global change, developments since the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, fourth assessment report. So, Phil.
All right, thank you, and good morning, everyone. This is indeed an update on global climate science since the IPCC 2007 assessment report, which was released almost exactly 2 years ago this week. And I stress that this is not in any way a substitute for the IPCC. The IPCC was created in 1988 under the auspices of the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations Environment Program. It's overseen by the IPCC plenary, which consists of appointed representatives of roughly 180 member nations. And all they do is really vote on the overall structure of the process. They don't have anything to do directly with creating the reports, although at the end of an assessment process, they look at the summary for policymakers and argue line by line about the language that the scientists came up with. The IPCC consists of three working groups, the scientific basis, which is really about the physical science, working group two, impacts, vulnerability, adaptation, working group three, mitigation. I was involved last time as one of 150 lead authors in working group one. We also had inputs from another roughly 300 contributing authors. It went through three rounds of peer review, and we had to document how we dealt with every single one of the comments that we received during the second and third rounds of peer review. Just to give you a sense of the scope, on the second round of peer review, we received 16,000 comments, and they were all delivered to the individual chapters in giant Excel spreadsheets, and we had to make sure that right-hand column was filled in all the way down, saying comment noted, comment accepted, or in some cases rejected, and we had to give a very strong reason. Now, my talk today is a follow-on to IPCC in that the content of the IPCC report was really wrapped in fall of 2006, so almost 2.5 years ago. It is not, however, in any way, shape, or form, an assessment. This is one guy who keeps sporadic tabs on the literature and has grabbed a few things that look interesting. So here are the 150 lead authors of the first assessment report. So again, a lot of people involved, and you got just one person here. So what I say is very much filtered through one person. It's not as sound as the IPCC report, and the same thing goes if you grab something off a website, which people sometimes do, of questionable quality. Well, just as a starting point, this is why we are concerned about what's happening to the planet's climate. This graph, which was from the summary for policymakers of the last IPCC report, it's probably familiar to many of you, it shows the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dating back 10,000 years, the entire span of human civilization. Most of the data is taken from bubbles of gas trapped in ice cores. That's the little colored symbols in the main plot, and you can also see some of them in the inset. And then the red curve in the inset represents direct observations of carbon dioxide taken from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, beginning in 1956. And what's very clear from this graph is that up until about 1900 or 1950, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was very stable at between 260 and 280 parts per million. That is less than 0.03% of the atmosphere. And once humans figured out how to dig coal out of the ground and burn it to get phenomenal amounts of energy with relatively little work, we altered the global carbon cycle in its geologic form, but with very rapid timescales. And hence, we produce so much carbon dioxide that the amount that accumulated in the atmosphere has risen 35%. And it's now actually up to about 38%. Now, carbon dioxide is a very important greenhouse gas. It traps heat in the atmosphere. So other things being equal, we would expect the carbon dioxide, the additional carbon dioxide, to add 1.5 watts per square meter, and that's the scale on the right-hand side. So that's a little bit like having a very weak Christmas tree light bulb every square meter all over the planet. That's a huge energy perturbation. So we would expect warming just from the rising CO2. Now, there are all sorts of other complicating factors. Water vapor goes up as the planet warms, so that produces additional warming. Clouds can go up or down in cloud amount. Ice melts and exposing darker surfaces, which produces additional warming. So there are all these complicating factors. But to first order, rising greenhouse gases will produce warming. So what's actually happened over the last 100 years? This slide, I think, is a triumph of simple storytelling. It's from the IPCC Summary for Policymakers, and it shows, number one, what happened with climate, and number two, why. The black curve shows the global average temperature in chunks, in 10-year averages, from through the 20th century. And you can see there was a bit of warming early in the 20th century, and then a period of sort of stable temperatures, and then more warming late in the 20th century. Now, if we had it to do over again, we could go back through the 20th century and see what the climate would have been like if we hadn't added greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. We can't do that with our real planet, but we can do it with climate models. These are like weather prediction models. They include all the physics of the atmosphere and the ocean. And they can be told there's a little more solar radiation, or it's wintertime, or there's a big volcanic eruption. And they will respond roughly as observed. When we tell them about solar variability and volcanic eruptions in the 20th century and let them produce their own El Nino events and so on, you get the blue shaded area. So you can see there was a little warming early in the 20th century, and then it would have cooled. Nothing like what actually happened. But if you then add the greenhouse gases, you get the red curve. So this tells us, number one, that rising greenhouse gases are the dominant factor in climate since the mid-20th century. Now, this doesn't in any way invalidate the existence of natural climate variability, but it says that the recent warming is largely because of rising greenhouse gases. Number two, it tells us that the climate models capture all of the essential physical processes involved in telling the climate story. So this is a very potent diagram because it shows why the IPCC concluded that most of the warming since the 20th century is very likely due to the rising greenhouse gases, which are certainly caused by humans. Let's just take a look at one other piece of evidence that it's not natural factors that's led to this recent warming. We've had satellite records of solar output going back to late 1978, so just over 30 years of record. And you can see this, the very nice 11-year solar cycle, max min, max min, max min. We're currently in solar minimum. But there is obviously no trend in solar radiation over that time. The maxes have all been about the same, and the minima have all been about the same. In fact, the recent solar minimum was a little lower than the previous ones. So solar variability certainly does not explain the recent warming. Now I want to move from IPCC to what has happened since. And I want to tell the first part of this story by highlighting this slide again. And now it's broken down into global land and global ocean. Notice there's that bump in the 1940s where the observed temperatures seem to stick way up above where they would as the climate models tell the story, given what we actually know happened with the radiative inputs. That bump does not appear on land. And many of us wondered what was going on with that, what the ocean was doing differently. And Dave Thompson, a graduate of the Atmospheric Sciences Department here, now a professor at Colorado State, published a fascinating paper last year that looked closely at the global temperature records. So this this diagram from their paper shows the global mean temperatures on the top, and this is now on a monthly time scale. So you can see much more detail than in the previous graph. And you can see that there was that huge bump in 1998, it was actually in December 1997, late 97, early 98, when the global mean temperatures spiked. And that was because of El Niño. So the second line there shows the part of that global temperature variability that's connected with El Niño and La Niña events. So you can see there was a very big bump, the biggest one of the 20th century, and then a pretty strong dip because there was a strong La Niña that followed it. So Dave then subtracted that out, and he subtracted out another index called the Cold Ocean Warm Land Index, which is the third time series there, and he got this residual global mean temperature at the bottom. You can see that a lot of the bumps and wiggles have sort of flattened out, but it's actually accentuated something very interesting in about 1945. Just to show you that El Niño event, this is a map of the Pacific Ocean. There's New Guinea on the far left and South America just off to the right. The equator runs through the middle, and this just shows the temperatures in December 1997 of the ocean surface. The bottom panel shows the temperature anomalies, that is, the differences from average. And much of the central and eastern Pacific was 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, that's up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than the long-term average. So the ocean was pumping a huge amount of heat into the atmosphere at this time, and that's why we saw that spike. Okay, back to the story. So here are the four time series, and let's focus on the bottom time series. And in particular, notice that there are several temporary dips circled here in blue. Not all of them are as obvious, but each of these corresponds to a major tropical volcanic eruption. The last one was Mount Pinatubo in 1991. These tropical volcanic eruptions pump huge amounts of ash and actually not ash, but sulfur compounds into the stratosphere, which reflect sunlight for a number of years. So we get a few years of global cooling. people have proposed doing this on an industrial scale to prevent runaway global warming. Some of us think there might be better uses for our technology than messing with the climate system that way, but nonetheless, nature does it. And so those volcanoes explain some of the dips in this record. But that leaves this very mysterious and very sudden drop in temperature in 1945. And it's quite a bit bigger than any of the volcanic eruptions. We know there were no volcanoes. And Thompson had also said, well, there were the nuclear explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. And Tom Ackerman, the director of the institute where I work here, had published papers on nuclear winter. Well, it turns out that the amount of nuclear material that was exploded in August 1945 was about 1/100th what would be needed to produce this amount of cooling. So that doesn't explain it. But Thompson and all kept digging, and they finally concluded the sudden drop in sea surface temperatures in late 1945 is consistent with the rapid but uncorrected change from engine room intake measurements aboard ships, which the U.S. ships predominated during World War II. After World War II, the British fleet was freed up to resume shipping, and they were still taking measurements from buckets, which have a cold bias. So this simple fact that World War II ended and the fraction of British ships on the seas greatly increased seems to explain this roughly 0.3 degrees Celsius drop in global temperatures, which goes a long way to smoothing out that global record and explaining one of the big puzzles. So that's an interesting development. Let's look at the global temperature records themselves. Updated now to 2008. This shows one red bar for each year, going back to 1880 and ending in 2008. Now, some people have suggested that global warming has stopped. And they take as a basis the fact that if you look just at the last 6 or 8 years, you see a sort of flattening of the global temperature curve. And this is all very interesting, but we know that greenhouse gases are rising rapidly. We know that they are exerting a strong physical influence toward warmer temperatures. So the question is such a flattening consistent with rising greenhouse gases? Well, all we have to do is look at global climate models. This is a set of dozens of climate model outputs globally averaged from 1950 to 2020. And the including observed forcings up to the year 2000. So you again see Mount Pinatubo as that strong dip in 1991. Well, if you look closely, any number of these individual runs has periods of 6 or 8 years where the temperatures flatten out, just as observed, even though the greenhouse gases continue to rise. So this is simply a matter of a noisy climate system doing something different in the short term from what it's doing in the long term. Looking at U.S. temperatures, 2008 was quite a bit cooler than recent years, so you can see, again, why people who think there is no reason to be concerned about global warming might be getting very excited, because 2008 was back near the long-term average temperature for the U.S. However, again, that's consistent with a strong La Niña event and with the low solar minimum, and very few climate scientists think that that will last very long. But in a few minutes, I'll come back to short-term predictions. Let's look at some other interesting developments since IPCC. This was a paper published in 2007 showing the minimum Arctic sea ice in summertime. The red curve shows the observations up to that point. The last year on there is 2006, and all the messy individual lines are Arctic summer ice from climate models. And the average of all the climate model outputs is the heavy black line, and then you can see the, I think it's the 5th and 95th percentiles are the other black lines. And so you can see the observations were indicating a faster loss of Arctic sea ice in 2006 than the models were suggesting. But if you look closely at some of the traces around 2040, you see quite a lot of them that just plunge very suddenly. And there seems to be a physical process, and this is what the authors of this paper speculated that sometime around 2040, we might get to the point where the Arctic ice was so thin that it simply couldn't survive a new summer very well. Well, this was published in spring of 2007, and as you may have heard, in the autumn of 2007, we set a smashing new global record with exactly the same kind of drop that these authors speculated could happen in 2040. Last March, Arctic sea ice was back to normal or even greater than normal extents, and we had a lively argument here at UW among sea ice experts about how much the September Arctic sea ice would rebound. Would it be back up to normal? Would it be at about 2005 levels? And actually, most of the experts concluded that it was likely to come in right around where 2007 was, even though we were starting out with much more ice. The reason was simply that it was so thin. Well, in fact, they were right. 2008 had almost as much open water as 2007. Here's a computer animation provided by NASA from satellite measurements of the ice in summer of 2008. And you can see how thin it was over on the Alaska side. It was very easy for it to break up, and the dark water underneath then absorbed more sunlight. So roughly half of the Arctic was ice-free last summer, and this was quite astonishing. Well, there is some concern. You know, look out ahead, and you go around the corner and look out. What sorts of surprises are we in for? That the Arctic sea ice was certainly one such surprise. Also in 2007, the fringes of Greenland melted at unprecedented rates. The red indicates areas where the 2008 amount of melting was substantially greater than the long-term average. Just published is this inventory of global glacier changes from the United Nations Environment Program's Glacier Monitoring Program. This is an inventory of roughly 1,800 glaciers using 36,000 length change observations and mass balance measurements from 230 glaciers. And this is an estimate of the global amount of water equivalent lost averaged over all these glaciers. And it's in meters, so from 1945 to 2005, roughly 20 meters of water equivalent has been lost from the world's glaciers. Now, I said I would get to a short-term forecast. This was a paper published last summer, or spring, summer, I can't remember exactly when, that used a climate model, but then input the observed sea surface temperatures to try to force the ocean model into doing what was consistent with the ocean, with the surface temperatures, and then ran it as a forecast over 10-year periods. So the red curve shows the observations. The black curve shows what you get if you just run a climate model without this input, and the green curve shows what you get with their approach. And this is a global mean surface temperature. And notice that they are forecasting for the 2000 to 2010 period, for the 10-year period centered on 2005, they're forecasting a bit of a cooling. Well, realclimate.org, which is a great resource for rapid response climate change science, discussed this paper and said, we wager 2,500 euros, and you know the euro is worth a heck of a lot more than a dollar these days, so that's a lot of money. If the 2000 to 2010 average temperature is lower than the 1994 to 2004 temperature. So in other words, if the temperature actually drops as forecast, they will pay 2,500 euros. Keenly's side declined to take the bet. And Real Climate pointed out that this green curve has predicted cooling twice before. You can see from 1960 to 1970, they predicted cooling. And again, from 1995 to 2000, they predicted cooling. So this method seems prone to predict cooling. And the authors themselves had so little confidence in it that they wouldn't take the wager. And even the authors themselves said, you know, we believe that in the long term we will see warming. It's just that they thought that in the next few years it might cool. Well, let's get a little more regional. This is a water seminar, so I want to touch on hydrology of the western region. This is from a package of papers produced by folks down at UC San Diego. This one is by David Pierce, and this slide represents the observed April 1st snow water equivalent averaged over nine mountain regions. And in each case, it's the April 1st snowpack divided by the winter precipitation. So in other words, at the end of the winter, how much of what fell do you get to keep? If it's a low amount, then that's not so good for water resources. And you can see that six out of these nine regions have seen statistically significant declines in this SWE over PE ratio, this catch efficiency. And they went on to do a formal detection and attribution study. I won't go into the details, but the bottom line, which was published in Science, was that up to 60% of the climate-related trends in river flow, winter air temperature, and snowpack in the western U.S., 1950 to 99, are human-induced. So the warming is affecting hydrology, and we can now say with some confidence that the warming is related to rising greenhouse gases, even on the scale of western mountains. Now, let's turn our attention toward the future, not just the very near future like Keenlyside, but the more distant future. So to estimate future climate change, we need, first of all, to think about how much greenhouse gases will there be. Will the globe wholesale adopt plug-in electric vehicles like the Zebra, the XEBRA? This is an actual vehicle you can buy. I've seen them on the streets of Seattle, although usually they're a dull green, not this fetching zebra striping. Or will we drive this sort of thing? Everybody needs one of these to bring your shopping home, right? And drive the soccer carpool. So obviously two very different greenhouse futures. Some might argue that both are equally plausible. The second thing we need to know is how responsive is the climate? Anybody know anything about the sport of curling? Has anyone ever watched it on TV?
Once.
Probably in the 2008 Winter Olympics, right? Curling is very popular in Canada and maybe a few other places. And the idea is that you shove this stone and you try to get it to go, you know, a certain distance. Well, we're shoving the climate system. When we let go of the climate system, how far will it coast on its own? That's the big question. How sensitive is the climate system? Is there a lot of friction on the ice so it'll sort of come to a stop quickly? Or will it just go racing off into the distance? Well, we can get estimates on the climate sensitivity different ways, but one way is just from the climate models themselves. And so this diagram represents the IPCC's summary of future temperature changes. These six letter number combinations on the right are different scenarios of future greenhouse gases from least to most. The B1 scenario, which is highlighted in blue, has a mere doubling of carbon dioxide in the 21st century, whereas A1FI, which isn't even shown on the main diagram, has carbon dioxide increasing by a factor of 3.5 above pre-industrial. So that's the left to right of the gray bars. The higher end of the gray bars are for climate models with more climate sensitivity. So that's the really vigorous push and long slide of the curling analogy. And depending on where you think the greenhouse gases will end up and how sensitive the climate system is, you can get a number anywhere from roughly 2 degrees Celsius or 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit all the way up to about 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a very big range of global average warming during the 21st century. Everything from, well, it might not be so bad, we'll have a few disruptions, to, wow, you know, ice-free Arctic, huge disruptions, large sea level rise, and so on. Well, that, again, that this was from the Summary for Policymakers 2007. Let's see where we actually are. Unfortunately, the scenarios used in the IPCC seem to have been optimistic in two respects. First of all, they assumed that economies would become more energy efficient. And although this is generally true of industrialized countries, it's not true of the globe as a whole. So that y-axis shows the change of energy intensity of gross domestic product, 2000 to 2010. And this is estimates from the IPCC scenarios, and then observations for 2000 to 2005 are actually slightly positive. On the x-axis is the other assumption, which is that energy sources will become less carbon intensive. So we'll add renewables faster than we add coal. And you can see only one of the main IPCC scenarios was positive, A1B. And the observations are actually positive. So the point that Pilkey and Wigley were making was that the idea of decarbonizing the global energy economy is a very, very tall order. And part of the reason is that, well, you know, we drive Hummers, and then when we go to the fitness club, we take the escalator, right? But it's not just Americans. China is building new coal-fired power plants at the rate of one or two a week. And this is the main driver. They want to be like us, okay? I was over in Beijing driving around, and everywhere you go, you see these billboards that say, that advertise subdivisions, and it could just as well be straight out of LA. It's things like Yosemite and Rancho Santa Fe. You know, that's, who can blame them? They want what we have. A paper that just came out a couple weeks ago by Susan Solomon, who was the co-chair of IPCC Working Group 1, explored the future for different scenarios beyond these IPCC scenarios. So this is just pick a number for the global carbon concentration and just leave it there. So let's suppose that we get up to 450. Remember, we're already at 380. So we'll probably hit 450 in the next few decades, unless we really hit the brakes. Maybe we'll hit 550. That's where B1 has us ending up. Maybe we'll level off at 650. So in this experiment, they ran a simple climate model with a carbon cycle model to see how fast the carbon would be drawn out of the air and how much the warming would reverse. And the point they made in this paper is that whatever level you choose to stabilize CO2, you have pretty well picked the average temperature of the planet for the next many centuries. It does not revert very much. So the y-axis is the global surface warming, and you can see that those each of those curves goes down a little bit as the ocean takes up some of that excess carbon, but then it pretty well stabilizes for a thousand years. So we are making choices every year, every decade, that ratchet up the global temperature in a nearly irreversible way. And what's even more worrisome is that we are also irreversibly causing the rising of the oceans. The ocean absorbs heat, and as ocean water heats, it expands. And this shows the amount of thermal expansion of the global ocean. This is completely separate from melting ice from glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica, which are also very worrisome. So if we level off at 450 parts per million, the estimate is that global thermal expansion will only be about 20 centimeters, which is about what it rose in the 20th century. That's not very much. But for every increment of CO2, we have picked a higher future sea level. And again, that's just from the thermal expansion. In addition to that, we would see anywhere from half a meter to several meters of sea level rise from Greenland and Antarctica over very, very long periods of time. And this is an irreversible change. Looking at regional effects, the IPCC included this nice map of changes in precipitation for the late 21st century minus the late 20th century. The green colors are increases of up to 50%, and the brown colors are decreases of down to 50%. And they're averaged over 21 models. And you can see in the December, January, February panel on the left, quite a lot lower precipitation in Mexico and Central America, but quite a bit more up in Canada. And that's simply because there's so much warming in the winter, the atmosphere carries more moisture, and so it snows harder. In the summertime on the right, you can see much of the continental U.S., and especially the Northwest, would see large decreases in precipitation. So we see this sort of accentuated seasonality in the Northwest, where the winter gets wetter and the summer gets drier. Now, in their paper, Solomon et al. Emphasized that all of these patterns of change become bigger and more robust the more CO2 you add to the atmosphere. So in other words, southwestern drought, which is already becoming a bit of a problem, could become very, very entrenched with average declines in precipitation of 15, 25, 30%. Those are very, very large changes. Focusing just on the Pacific Northwest, the Climate Impacts Group, which is about to release a major report on impacts of climate change on Washington State. You'll probably see some press about that in the next couple of days. We've looked at the same set of climate model scenarios for the A1B, which is a sort of middle scenario, and the B1, which is the optimistic, you know, plug-in zebra kind of scenario. And there's not a whole lot of difference in the 2040s between those two scenarios, just because there's such a slow response time of the global energy system. So on the right-hand panel here, this summarizes the annual mean temperature changes from these 20 models. The circles and the left bar are for the B1 scenario, and the X's in the right-hand bar are for the A1B scenario. And this is just over a 60-year period. So the B1 scenario would give us, on average, 3 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. So that's half a degree Fahrenheit per decade. A1B, a bit more. The hottest model gives us 5 degrees of warming over that period. That's almost 1 degree per decade. And the coolest model with the coolest scenario, 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So quite a wide range, just as with the global average. Now, the rest of those pairs of bars show the breakdown by season. And the main story here is much more warming in summer than in the other seasons, according to these models. This is the same thing for precipitation change. And unlike the map that I just showed you, which was for late in the century, by mid-century, there's still a lot of disagreement among models about whether the region will get wetter or drier. They do tend toward wetter winters and drier summers, but that's a pattern that hasn't clearly emerged by mid-century. Focusing on water resources, I think a good starting point is this diagram from a paper published by Bales et al. This is actually a slightly different version than what's in the paper. It shows the fraction of annual precipitation falling in the temperature range -6 to 0 degrees Celsius. This is what we might call warm snow. It's not rain, and it's not very cold snow. And you can see that the West, as a whole, gets something like a third of its precipitation in this category. But if you look at the mountains, the Sierra Nevada and Cascade Mountains, they're all lit up in red, meaning more than half of our annual precipitation in those areas falls as warm snow. So if we start warming the climate, then we would expect to see a shift from this from snow dominant to a more rain dominant hydrology system. And indeed, that's what hydrologic models say should happen. This is hydrograph, that is the mean monthly flow from the Snake River at Ice Harbor Dam, that's where it flows into the Columbia, simulated with 20th century climate, that's the black curve, and then the climate of the 2030s and 2050s, yeah, that's the blue and the red curves. And you can see there are three changes. There's an increase in winter runoff because more of the winter precipitation is falling as rain in lower elevation areas. Second, you can see a big decrease in summer runoff, and that's a huge concern for irrigated agriculture, for hydropower, for fish flows. It's happy news for flood control, because obviously the flood risk goes down if you have this kind of hydrograph. The third shift, and that's a little more subtle, is toward earlier peak flow, not as obvious from monthly time step. Now, it turns out that observations show that all of these changes have already been observed. And that gets back to the statement that Barnett et al. Made that I highlighted earlier. I'd chalk it up to another crazy backyard hobby, except he's the world's leading authority on global warming. People have asked us repeatedly, how much sea level rise should we plan for? And while I wouldn't advocate building an ark, we produced a report last year summarizing global climate science and trying to come to some statements about what the sea level rise could be in the coastal waters of Washington State. And the real problem is that we don't know what's going to happen with Greenland and Antarctica. Big, big unknowns. But this is sort of what we came up with. It depends on your risk tolerance and your time horizon. So these bars indicate the range of sea level rise in inches. 2050 on the left, our best guess was 6 inches. That's not very much. But if you're risk averse, let's say you're going to plunk $100 million of infrastructure down a few feet above current high water, you might be more concerned with that 20-inch figure. If, in addition, you are planning out to 2100, you probably want to take the right-hand bar. And again, it depends on your risk tolerance. And we've been consulted about these sea level rise estimates as they apply to many, many different planning contexts. And in most cases, people really want that sort of worst-case scenario. They want to make sure that they're planning for the worst-case scenario. Finally, I want to bring this around to a very local, short-term perspective. This is a photo of Centralia in December 2007 when the Chehalis River flooded. And, of course, this happened again just last month. And so people are wondering, have heavy precipitation events increased in the Northwest? Has the incidence of severe floods increased? And if so, are these due to global warming? Does it mean that these things are going to get worse in the future? And much as I would love to be able to give solid answers, I have to say the answers to the first two of these are equivocal, and to the bottom one is we really, really don't know. So although it's tempting to hang these things on the hook of a rapidly changing climate gone haywire under the influence of greenhouse gases, the science at this point doesn't support that. I would note this figure from a paper by Ken Kunkel, looking at extreme precipitation events over the entire 20th century, so that's 1900 to 2000, indicated that there had been a significantly positive change, a significant increase in extreme precipitation events in the Northwest. And when he broke this down by season, he found that this was really dominated by increases in November to December heavy rainfall, like what we've recently experienced. And I would stress again that this analysis ended in 2000. And, of course, we've had some events since then that would tend to bump this up. But there are other studies that use different time periods and get different answers, so it's not clear really what's happened. So I want to wrap up. Global warming continues. It has not stopped. It may have paused briefly, but we have no reason to believe that temperatures in 20 years globally will be below where they are now. Regional impacts are dominated by shifts in snowmelt-driven hydrology. I highlighted some of those effects, but even things fairly far removed from rivers, like forests, are affected by snowmelt-driven hydrology. Anthony Westerling has shown that forest fires are much more prevalent in years when the snow melts early. Finally, for local extremes, it's very much an open question, an area of active research. Thank you, and I'd love to take some questions.
In one of your earlier slides, it showed a graph of the temperature. Yeah, and then the red line is direct observation. Since there are two different sampling techniques, it seems like it spikes up a lot more once you use a different sampling technique.
Yeah, well, in fact...
Can you repeat the
question? Yeah, so the question is... Could this difference in the character of the graph be related to the fact that we're mixing two different sampling techniques, direct measurements versus the ice core data? And in fact, you can sort of see in the right-hand bar, those ice core measurements do go all the way up. They match fairly well. Now, the fern, the ice doesn't actually close up immediately, so there's about a 20-year lag. So you don't get the last few points on there, but they do actually match quite well.
Other questions?
So do I've heard some people say that there's a large potential for further positive feedback loops in the climate system that we haven't discovered yet, that we don't know about, and I'm wondering if you could comment on whether or not the majority of scientists, if you will, feel that there is this danger of further positive feedback loops that we don't know about, or if people are on either side of the fence in terms of whether or not our predictions are underpredicting or overpredicting.
The question is, could there be dramatic positive feedback loops that we haven't seen yet that could make these projections of future temperature change even too low? Is that a fair synopsis? Well, I guess the answer is we don't know. We won't know until we get there. The climate models seem to have the right strength of the feedbacks that they do have, at least for the climate changes that we have seen. Should that reassure us? Well, let's go back and look at the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum about 55 million years ago. We know from paleo evidence that there were alligators living in Ellesmere Island in northern Canada and palm trees in Wyoming. These things would not be possible if the temperatures got significantly below freezing for very much of the time. When you plug in as much as we know about the world then into climate models, including the fact that CO2 was at something like 2,000 parts per million, you still get climates that are much too cool. That's worrisome because that suggests the existence of some positive feedback, as you suggest, that is yet undiscovered and is not in climate models. And at what point would we trigger it? Would we trigger it at 450 or at 1500? We don't know. Or is it just that the processes in the models don't work well at that level? So I would say scientists are worried about things like that. We tend not to present those worries in graphical form because they are unsupported by our modeling, but that's sort of circular reasoning. The models don't show it, therefore they're not in our projections, but what if the models are wrong?
If the models did actually predict that sort of discontinuous drop in Arctic sea ice just at a later date than where it actually seems to be occurring, do you expect the next IPCC report to be in fact predicting for the next 40 or 50 years substantially more actual global warming and other sort of longer term changes occurring earlier than had been earlier predicted?
The question is, given things like the rapid decline of sea ice, will we see a different story emerging in the next IPCC report? The next report is due out in 2013. So a year from now, they'll be drawing up the author teams and so on. The reports are based on published literature. So the projections that are included in the report will depend on what people actually do. Clearly, the study that I showed indicated that the models have really missed how sensitive Arctic sea ice is. Partly that's because there was a series of factors, not just rising greenhouse gases, but to do with unusual winds that triggered that rapid decline in Arctic sea ice. But now we're there. and it seems like the Arctic ice can't recover because the new ice is less than a meter thick. It's very easily broken up, and it's very difficult for thin ice to survive the next summer.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.